Hello and welcome to Story Talk. This is episode number 6. I'm your host, Laura Randall, and today we'll be talking about the Lego Movie 2, the second part by Warner Brothers Pictures. It came out just earlier this year in February of 2019, and it is a fascinating movie. It's brilliantly written, and I know that's something we're not used to saying about kids' movies, but you already know that I love animation. I studied animation in college, and so I love looking at movies that come out specifically for children with fresh eyes as an adult, because there are adults working on these movies. They make them accessible to children, but for the best animated movies, that just makes them better for adults too. The writing in this movie is like that. It is accessible to children, it's funny to children, it's engaging for children, but it's also really interesting to look at as an adult, and especially as a parent or a caregiver or someone who is assisting children, guiding them through the growing up years, because this movie is essentially a coming of age film, and it is exceptionally direct about being about growing up. Sometimes for movies, when the theme is stated really directly like this, it can be almost a kiss of death, that it becomes too obvious or too trite or too predictable because the theme is stated too early or too often. But in this case, the writers have treated the theme of growing up and also the concept of movie making and storytelling in general, much like a master builder of Legos would treat an already constructed piece. They see what's there, they appreciate the shapes or the parameters or the building blocks, the bricks that have gone into building that thing, but then they can break it down and make something else out of it, make something new. They can change it from the inside because they know how to manipulate the building blocks. And the writers for Lego 2 have done that with the story itself. They've kind of hollowed out the predictable elements of a story like this and played with our expectations, and they play with them the whole way through the movie. They set characters up to be something that they actually aren't. They have bad guys who aren't really bad. They have good guys who aren't really good. They have endings where there shouldn't be endings. They have tragedies in the middle of this incredibly funny, witty children's drama. It's a fascinating movie, and I would highly encourage you to watch it before you listen to this episode. Sometimes it doesn't really matter if you listen to this episode or if you watch the movie first, but in this case, I definitely recommend that you watch the movie before you listen to this episode, before you get any of the surprises revealed. Because the surprises about the plot and the way that the storytellers have played with the concept of storytelling is one of the main features of this movie, and you can't get the full effect if you know the surprises beforehand. So watch it first, get all the enjoyment out of having those surprises unspoiled, and then come back and analyze the story with us, because it's so much fun to talk about. There are so many things to talk about, and we will only touch on a couple, but you will undoubtedly find new or more interesting ways to talk about it with the people around you. So without further ado, let's dive in to the Lego Movie 2, the second part. The title is no accident, of course. The repetitiveness and the directness towards itself is a theme that goes through the whole movie. The characters and the songs are often breaking the fourth wall to show us that they are in the movie, but they are also outside of the movie. They are also self-aware within the movie. For example, at one point, Wildstyle, or Lucy, is meeting the queen of the Systar system. And at this point, they think that the Systar system is unequivocally bad. And when the queen of the Sistar system attempts to convince them that she's genuine. She sings a very much a villain song about how not evil she is. And Lucy, at the very beginning of this song, says, "Oh, wait, are we in a musical?" And then they go through and they have a musical storytelling piece. And then the whole way through the song, she's commenting that it's extremely suspicious that the queen is singing this song about not being evil. It's very self-conscious that way. Lucy knows what kind of story to expect from this song. And thus, she represents a character who is basically as educated as the audience is on the expectations for the story. And because the queen sings this very villain-like song, Lucy assumes she's a villain, which we do too as an audience. And that kind of playfulness with the audience's expectations is constantly going on through the movie. There's this witty, self-conscious, almost self-deprecating humor that the writers have employed to give us a movie that we entirely expect and at the same time completely don't expect. This touches on an interesting topic, which we have not really addressed directly in this podcast yet. And I'd like to call it the law of the story, because there are certain rules that a story must abide by in order for an audience to accept it. The way that characters are established, or the way that the story is set up, the way that the story begins, what starts the story, all tell the audience, they give the audience clues about what to expect from the end of the story. And it's a really interesting dance that writers do with the audience as they tell stories, because they have to give the audience enough information that the audience knows in general what to expect and when to expect those things, but not so much information that they know all of the secrets for the story before they happen. You still want the audience to be curious about how these things are going to come to be. You just want to give like a little appetizer of clues at the beginning of the story to convince the audience that you as a storyteller know what you're doing, and therefore they should follow you through the telling of this story. So the law of the story is, as a very generalized definition, the set of agreed upon expectations that are shared between the audience and the writer. And the clues that a writer gives to the audience at the beginning of the story indicate to the audience what they can expect by the end of the story. For example, when we walk in to Lego Movie 2, we do not sit down expecting a deep philosophical treatise. We don't expect a tragedy in the style of Hamlet or Macbeth or something like that. We don't expect to have a heavy political theme, for example, because that wouldn't match our expectations of a children's movie. It wouldn't match our expectations of a Lego movie with the legacy that the Lego movies have already given us through the first Lego movie, through the Batman movie, through the Lego Ninjago movie. All of those movies have set up a kind of template for us as an audience for what to expect from the Lego 2 movie. And so when we walk into the Lego 2 movie, we do expect that the good guys are going to win. We do expect that the bad guy will be somewhat punished for his bad actions, but probably not in a way that will really cause us a lot of heartache as the audience. We do expect all of the main characters to survive and thrive by the end of the movie. And we expect a lot of other things along the way too, like comedic timing. We expect witty banter. We expect the funny characters that we've come to really like Batman and Emmett and Lucy, and they're all there. And so when the movie opens up and we see the beginnings of all those things, we see that the characters are still funny. There's still this witty comedic timing. There's still a self-consciousness about being Legos. We are then additionally primed to know what's going to happen through the movie, even though we don't know the play-by-play of how the story will go. Now, we can sense all of this innately. This is automatic for most of us to understand stories like this, to connect them to other stories that we know, to connect them to our own lives, to set up this framework of expectations for the story. And what I think is really interesting here is that the writers have accepted that framework, and they do give us a happy ending. All of the things that we expect by the end of the movie do happen, but they mess with us the whole way along. They don't give us the things in the order that we think they are going to give them, and they don't give us the things we expect in the way that we expect them. For a significant portion of screen time, we as an audience think that they are telling a dystopian tale about an underdog society with a false utopia, and that the false utopia is somehow trying to subjugate or destroy the other society, so the other society is fighting back. And what we learn by the end is that actually the utopian society was trying to help the other society, and by fighting back, they actually both get destroyed. And this creates a lot of tension and a lot of curiosity for us as the audience, because we can't tell what they're going to do. And then they do things like give us a false ending. They have a "the end" sign in Legos appearing on the screen at the most tragic downer point in the movie. And we know as the audience, because of the law of the story, that this should be a happy ending. And so we feel kind of confused and lost. And then even the character, Lucy, who is our representative as the audience within the story, she says, "Wait, no, this can't be the end. You can't just leave us here on this cliffhanger ending. Like, this isn't okay." And she knows the law of the story. She knows there's supposed to be a happy ending. And so she then goes back into her persona as a character within the story, and she changes things. And her change is the first domino that brings into effect the actual ending of the movie, which is actually happy. Another fascinating thing that they have done with the law of the story and with our expectations as audience members is that they've taken what appears to be a funny drama, much like a melodrama. I hesitate to say melodrama because usually in melodramas, the good guys and bad guys are very clearly defined, and you know the whole time who the good guys and the bad guys are. And this movie, as we've already established, plays with that line, and it gives us bad guys who aren't really bad and good guys who aren't really good. So it plays with that line, but the characters always think that there is a stark difference between the good guys and the bad guys. And when it switches, then it's still clear. It's just flipped. So the line is still there, but the sides have switched. And the new bad guy is clearly bad, and the new good guys are clearly good at that point. And they continue that way. So it's much like a melodrama. It's enough like it that we could call it a melodrama. So it's a melodrama where we have these clear stakes, these clear sides. And in a melodrama, one of the rules is that the good guys win. But within this melodrama, and it's a children's melodrama too, which means that it is very safe. The characters don't die. And if they did die, it would be really upsetting for the audience. And also the characters' motives are relatively straightforward. But they've nested within this children's melodrama two potential tragedies. They have these two sub stories that are kind of nested within the large story that is happening in the Lego world that we are watching. And one of the stories is between the parents and the kids. The parents watching the kids and telling them they either can or can't play with the Legos, which would be a high stakes decision for everyone that we care about in the movie, all of the Lego characters. And then we also have tension between the two siblings who are playing with Legos, between the brother and the sister. And both of these sub-stories, both of the stories that happen in the human world, set themselves up as potential tragedies. The parents are telling the kids the whole time, you've got to get along, you've got to play together nicely, you can't keep fighting or we take the Legos away, we're going to have you put them in storage, etc. But we can see through the Lego world that they are still fighting. So there's that potential tragedy. The kids are sabotaging their own opportunities to play with the Legos by continually fighting over the Legos. Then the second tragedy is between the brother and the sister. And the sister just wants the brother to play with him. And for anyone who has raised kids, who has been a sibling, it's obvious that that's what's happening the whole time. She just wants to play with him, but doesn't really know how, doesn't know how to be a cool older kid, doesn't know how to be a good playmate for her big brother. She just desperately wants to engage with him in the cool games that he's playing. And so she keeps trying to insert herself into his games, but actually just destroys them and makes him really angry and antagonistic towards her. And there's that tragedy that sets up this tragedy between the brother and the sister, where the sister is continually sabotaging herself in her efforts to try and play with the brother. And in the big crisis of the movie, both of these tragedies are realized. The brother completely rejects the sister. He breaks her things. He yells at her for taking his stuff. He makes it very clear that he does not want to play with her, that he doesn't think she's cool. It's a total rejection of the sister. And because of this fighting between the kids, then the mom comes in and asks them to put the Legos in storage. So we have the second tragedy realized. And as the two siblings are isolated apart from each other and they're clearing away their Legos, and all of the Lego characters are despairing as they fall into the bin of storage, we feel rather let down. The tempo, the pace of the film, and the abundance of comic relief, even throughout these two tragedies being realized, softens the blow of them a lot for us as an audience, and we don't really expect this to be the end, and we don't expect them to stay in the bin of storage, the storage bins. We expect it to resolve, but it's also rather unexpected that it happened at all. We kind of expected as an audience that Emmett, through his pre-knowledge of what was going to happen in the Sistar system, and his goodness as a character, his status as the hero from the previous Lego movie, we thought that all of those things would help him to avert the crises that he is trying to prevent. When they do happen, we as an audience are left very dependent on the storytellers, because we've invested a lot in these characters now. We've been with them for, 50-ish minutes in this movie alone, and we care about them. We care about what happens to them, but we don't know how they're going to get out of the storage bin. We don't know how this story is going to continue or to resolve. And that's a really great move from the writers, because it anchors this bright, colorful, poppy, silly, fantastical story that they've been telling through the Legos. It anchors that story into some real emotional roots, into the real relationship between these siblings, It requires us to face the disappointment that we have all felt at some point of wanting to play or be a part of someone's group that we felt was cooler than we were, that was above where we were, and we tried so hard to be a part of that thing and just failed. And by giving us these nested tragedies within this overall melodrama, we have a safe place to experience those emotions in a lighthearted way and then resolve them in a really meaningful way. Because the resolution is not at all kitschy. The resolution requires real forgiveness between the brother and the sister. It requires a change of heart. And we'll talk about in a minute some of the themes, and the heart is a big theme, the heart versus the head. And the brother has to return to his childlike heart, to his acceptance of his sister, in order to repair these broken relationships that have isolated everyone in the family. And that's a real thing. It's done in a lighthearted way, and it's done with a lot of comic relief and a lot of witty banter and a lot of silliness and a lot of pop songs. But that's a growth cycle that we all need. And I love that they took this silly movie and they gave it a real heart, a real moment of growth at the center of the crisis. And even with all of the fun, crazy things that they do on the sides, they make room for this to happen. And they make it clear that this is the most important thing that happens in the movie, is this change of heart. It's beautifully done. It's beautifully done. I can't say enough good things about it. It showcases, I think, one of the big strengths of children's movies, which is that they manage to get into the really vulnerable parts of our lives by telling stories that are so far away from reality. Children's stories become vapid and useless when they stay in the fantastical realm only. But this is the prime spot of what children's stories can do, is that they get you to have a lot of fun. They have funny characters with good dialogue and fun effects and this veritable visual feast. But then they give it a real heart with real change and real emotional momentum that can carry over from the movie into our actual lives. It can show us how to change in ways that we maybe have been ignoring, or show us how to grow in ways that we haven't wanted to admit that we need to grow. And that's what the Lego Movie 2 does at its center. It provides a safe place for children and adults, for anyone watching the movie, to experience the same embarrassment and the same awkwardness that comes through the mismatch of the play styles between the siblings, and then to overcome it through love, through forgiveness, through kindness. And it tells that story in two different ways. One through the human world, and then one through the Lego world too. But it doesn't say exactly the same thing in both of the worlds. They each have their own way of coming to this resolution. But the way that the writers have woven it together, it's a masterful illustration of how love conquers all, of how open-heartedness is more powerful than hard-heartedness. So now would be a good time to talk about this theme that is developed so well throughout the movie, the theme of the head versus the heart. One of the central questions that seems to be asked by this movie is, what is motivating your decisions? And we're given two characters with opposite decision-making styles to follow in their growth through this movie. One is Lucy, one is Emmett. At the beginning of the movie, Emmett makes all of his decisions based on his heart, what he's feeling at the time. He's the same open, trusting, optimistic, guy that we met in the first Lego movie. Lucy is also very much the same as the wild style that we met in the previous movie, and she makes her decisions based on her head, how she thinks about things, how reasonable or unreasonable something is, whether she is suspicious of something or not. And at the beginning of the Lego story, there is an important conversation between Emmett and Lucy in which Lucy essentially asks Emmett to forego making his decisions based on his heart and start making decisions with his head. And the name that she gives this is growing up, and this is a theme that is poked and prodded and questioned and stretched throughout the movie. So it's not a single definition. There isn't a single definition for growing up, but it's a theme that they really test in this movie to figure out what it means. And when Lucy asks Emmett to grow up for her, what she is really asking is for him to stop making decisions impulsively with his heart and start making decisions more like her, to make decisions more with his head. Emmett really tries to do this. He sees how important it is to Lucy. Lucy is important to him. And somewhat ironically, he tries to follow his heart to Lucy by prioritizing his head. Thus, when he meets another character in the story named Rex, who's really tough, really cool, really knows how to problem solve, he's a cool, broody master breaker. And Emmett recognizes that this is the kind of person Lucy wants him to be. She wants him to grow up into a hardened, tough guy like this. So Emmett asks this character, Rex, he asks him to help him grow up so that he can become the person that Lucy wants him to be. And Rex obliges, and the whole way through the movie, he's giving Emmett advice. He's telling Emmett not to care about things that Emmett clearly does care about. When they land on one of the Sistar system alien planets, and there are all of these aliens with big eyes surrounding them, and Emmett and Rex are trying to escape, and they're driving this big car, and there are a bunch of aliens blocking their way. Rex starts telling Emmett, don't let them take advantage of you. Don't let them take advantage of that big, beautiful heart of yours. You know, just bust right through them. Just drive right over them. And then again, when Emmett is trying to learn how to be like Rex, Rex is teaching him how to be a master breaker, teaching him how to break through the worlds of the Sistar system. And to do that, Rex says he has to access these big grown-up feelings like abandonment and anger and regret, and that's how to be grown up, is to draw power from these negative feelings in order to break things. Lucy, meanwhile, is also learning about growing up and hard-heartedness and open-heartedness and the differences between these things. And in her adventure, she is captured by one of the Sistar system aliens, and they go back to the Sistar system, and she's very suspicious of everything. She's suspicious of the queen, especially when the queen sings her villain song, which is actually a false villain song. But Lucy is suspicious of that, and she's commenting the whole way through about how she's not going to believe it. She doesn't trust them. She doesn't believe that they are trying to do something good, or that the matrimonial ceremony that the queen is planning is going to be a good thing for everyone, like they say. And when Lucy is taken to the Sparkle Planet to get changed, those are the words that the queen uses to describe what's going to happen to them. She says, you need to get changed for the ceremony, and Lucy needs to get changed most of all. So when they take them to this Sparkle Planet, Lucy is constantly on guard. She refuses to enjoy any of the treatments that they put her through. She's really disappointed by her friends engaging in the treatments, and especially when they start dancing to the pop music that's there and they start having fun with what's happening in the Sistar system. She's really frustrated with them. And her main way of trying to escape being brainwashed, or what she thinks is of as being brainwashed, is to get headphones to block out the sound, to refuse any interaction with the sensations, and to stay in her own head. And we see in this scene a lot of the head themes, that the problem is people being brainwashed, and the way to protect yourself is to stay in your own head, to keep thinking, think more, think better, think more alone. And when she joins up with Emmett and Rex again, and they enact their plan for how to take down the matrimonial ceremony and supposedly save the day, no surprise, they use headsets. And I think that may or may not have been intentionally symbolic, but there are a lot of symbols that can happen in storytelling, even unintentionally by the storytellers. And I think this might be one of those unintentional symbols that happened just because they were good writers and good storytellers. And they've got this theme about the head and the heart going through the whole film. And then here at the crux, the headset is what is going to keep them, Rex, Emmett, and Lucy, outside of the celebrations for the matrimonial ceremony. It's going to keep them from being brainwashed. It's going to connect them to each other, but isolate them from everyone else. And a critical moment in the crisis sequence is when Lucy gets her headset knocked off. And Emmett can no longer hear her through the headset, and Lucy is no longer isolated in her headphones or in a headset. And that's when she makes a real turning point and starts to realize that it's more important to care about people than it is to think about them. She's had all of these thoughts and suspicions about General Mayhem and about the Queen and about the matrimonial ceremony and all of these other things that have prevented her from caring about anyone in the Sistar system. When she engages in this fight with General Mayhem, who's like the head alien under the Queen, she knocks off General Mayhem's helmet and realizes that it's this sweet, accessible manga type Lego character who doesn't look evil at all. And as General Mayhem is hanging for her Lego life from the edge of a precipice, Lucy, who has been fighting with the masked version of General Mayhem up until this point, looks at her for the first time and realizes that they're not so different. And so she starts to care about her, and then she has to try and talk herself out of it. She says, "No, I'm not falling for it. I'm not going to care about you." And then when General Mayhem falls, Lucy quickly master builds an extension to the precipice so that she can reach down and catch her. And when they get back up to the top, General Mayhem says, "Oh, you do care. I knew there was some sweetness under that darkness." And they have a whole exposé where Lucy lays out her suspicions and General Mayhem tells Lucy what's actually happening. And Lucy is really surprised because it turns out that the Sistar system and the Queen are much more innocent than Lucy had thought. And that if Lucy had allowed herself to think less and feel more for the Sistar system, she would have perceived it more accurately than just thinking alone. And that leads into Lucy's actual confrontation with the matrimonial ceremony and the climax too for this theme of the head versus the heart, where Emmett, who has been trying this whole time to get into his own head, to toughen up his heart and to start growing up and using his head. He's wearing his headset. He's connected to Rex. They've got this plan for how they're going to destroy the matrimonial system. And when Lucy comes and appeals to Emmett's heart, he pushes her away. And this is all happening at the same time that the Queen is revealing her true form, which is a heart It's the heart that the brother gives to the sister as a token of peace when they first came downstairs to play with Legos together. And after that, it broke apart, literally and figuratively, because the sister didn't know how to play at the brother's level. And so the brother began protecting himself from her in his playing, and then figuratively protecting himself in his heart too, hardening his heart towards his sister. We have the queen whatevra wannabe, revealing herself as a heart as Emmett sticks to his headset. He chooses hard-heartedness over open-heartedness when Lucy appeals to him, and he goes up and he breaks the space temple that is the focal point for this matrimonial ceremony, and in doing so triggers our Momageddon, where all of the Legos go into storage, because it was a symbol for the kids fighting over the Legos again, and the mom comes in and tells them to put them in storage. So this is a really cool theme to watch for, and it's one of those rare themes in the movie that is so thoroughly woven into the story that it's difficult to extract portions of it for analysis without taking the rest of it too. If you take one part of the theme, the head versus the heart, all of the other parts of the theme start coming with it, and you start to have to talk about each moment of the whole movie because it's so well woven in into the whole fabric of the story. But there's another key moment for the head versus heart conversation that I'll just touch on before we leave this one alone. And that is the moment that happens after the ceremony between Rex and Emmett. As Emmett destroys the space temple that serves as the focal point of the matrimonial ceremony, everything starts to collapse and everyone is unhappy. And it's exactly the opposite of what Emmett thought would happen when he did this master breaker move. He thought that growing up and getting into his head, making decisions with his head, he thought that getting hard-hearted and grown up like this would make him into a hero again, and that Lucy would love him and everybody would admire him and he would have saved the day. And he had all these visions of how he would deliver this master blow and break up the space temple, and then he would swoop down and save his friends and they would all think he was the coolest, and Lucy would say, "Oh, you're all changed for the better. You've changed perfectly." What actually happens is that Emmett breaks the temple and everyone is distraught. Lucy is completely disappointed and rejected by Emmett because for one of the first times, she really appealed to him through his language of the heart and he rejected her. And then breaking the space temple destroyed Queen Whatevra, and she falls to pieces, and everyone within the ceremony begins to cry and fall into pieces. Just before Emmett can try to repair the situation and reach out to Lucy again, Rex swoops in, grabs only Emmett, and takes him away again. And this is a great visual representation of the thematic message that the movie is trying to bring across, which is that hard-heartedness leads to isolation. And for Emmett, his decision to harden his heart towards Lucy and the rest of the Sistar system directly leads to being isolated with only himself, because we find out that Rex is him from the future. And furthermore, we find out that Rex in his alternate reality spent years under the dryer hardening his heart so that he wouldn't be affected by anyone. And once he finally got the chance to do something again, the only thing he wanted to do was to save himself. So he went back in time to save his past self, and that was Emmett. And when Emmett voices concern over the fact that Rex has tricked him into hurting his friends. Rex says, "No, I just taught you to harden your heart exactly like you asked me to." And Emmett realizes that the goal that he's been striving for, to harden his heart and to grow up, isn't actually the way to get what he truly wants, which is connection. He wants connection with Lucy and with his friends. He wants people to be happy. And that the way to achieve those goals is not, in fact, through hardening his heart, through growing up, through only using his head and being by himself. When Emmett voices this decision that he would rather have friends than be protected like this, than be isolated and grown up, Rex is really disappointed in him, and he decides to throw Emmett under the dryer to fix him, to give him some time to harden on his own. And after some time under the dryer, while Emmett is watching his friends being put away into the storage bins, Rex comes again to Emmett to break him. He's a master breaker, and that goes along with the hardening of the heart, that it requires those negative, isolating emotions to be grown up and be a master breaker. And that's what Rex embodies. And he comes to break Emmett. And when he approaches Emmett, he says, "It'll be easy because you're weak." The open-heartedness is a weakness in Rex's eyes. And Emmett's response is the perfect synthesis moment for the whole movie. It combines all of the themes. And he says, "No, you're weak. I'll never grow up to be like you. It's easy to harden your heart, but to open it is the toughest thing that you can do." So then there's the playing with the idea of toughness and openness, and Emmett is finally realizing that the most difficult thing, the most grown-up thing, the hardest, toughest thing to do is actually to be open-hearted, to choose open-heartedness, even when there are reasons to be suspicious. Anyway, back to his dialogue. He says, I am going to grow up, but I'm not going to stop caring about the people in my life. They may see the world differently, but that's not bad. That's inspiring." And then we have one of the other great writing decisions of this movie, which is the reincorporation of the Everything is Awesome song, but remixed with additional lyrics so that it matures along with these characters, and matures in a genuine way, not in the superficial, hard-hearted way. Because Emmett says, "Everything isn't awesome, but we could make it a little more awesome if we just remembered that we weren't alone in this world." And bam, that's just a beautiful recap, synthesis, tying up of all of the themes that this movie has been developing. And we didn't even really notice how deep all of the themes were in their separate threads before they came together in this moment. But this little piece of dialogue from Emmett ties everything together, and it's delivered at the perfect time. He hasn't yet been rescued from his situation. So he's saying it even though he knows, or thinks he knows, that Rex is about to end him as a character. He's about to break him apart. And it's only after he makes this decision to be open-hearted at all costs, even if it hurts him, that's when Lucy finally breaks through. She makes it to Emmett. She saves him from Rex. Emmett gets squished back together. And once he's made this decision never to grow up and be like Rex, then Rex begins to disappear, because he is the future Emmett. And if Emmett decides not to be him, then he stops existing. And there again, the writers soften it a lot for us by adding plenty of comic relief. But there's still the satisfaction of knowing that the villain, the bad guy, didn't get away with what he was doing. And he had the appropriate consequence for his badness. In this case, the consequence for his extreme hard-heartedness was to be left alone and ultimately to die alone, because that's essentially what has happened to him once he's disappearing, is that he's dying. He's no longer existing. And so we have the natural story law being kept in its essential by giving Rex consequences for being the bad guy, even though the whole way through the movie, they were playing with his character and making us wonder, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Is he going to help Emmett? Is he going to hurt Emmett? And finally, at the end, all of the things resolve in the way that they should. We just didn't know how they were going to resolve until the moment that they do. To resolve the human conflicts at the same time as this is going on with Lucy, Emmett, and Rex, these clips are then intercut with the brother as he remembers that he once gave the heart to his sister and taught her how to play Legos. And he recognizes how hard his sister has tried to play with him, even though it's been unsuccessful. And he decides to extend the forgiveness towards her for messing up his games and for taking his characters and for invading his space. He decides to extend forgiveness towards her again and offer her the Lego heart again. And the Lego heart, of course, is the queen, which means that when he gives her back the Lego heart, the queen re-emerges as a part of the story again, and the sister and the brother get to play together and they reconcile. So in the end, there are a lot of fascinating things about the Lego Movie 2. I won't go into any more of them in detail, but whether you are a seasoned story analyst or just beginning to think about how media is affecting us as consumers or somewhere in between, wherever you are in your story analysis abilities, this is a great movie to try your hand at, because there's a lot of material, a lot of excellent dialogue ready to be broken apart and analyzed. And it's really fun to watch. You can watch this movie multiple times in the same sitting even and not get tired of it, because it's very quick paced and the visuals are fun. And so in terms of story analysis, this is a great place to start. And if you have kids, this is a great place to start introducing story analysis to them too, because they will very willingly watch the movie with you, and then you can start to identify some of the bigger themes that are going on in the movie and the ways that the story can spill over into our lives, teach us valuable things, or show us examples of how to react in certain situations. And especially if your kids have siblings, I think that would generate a lot of interesting conversations. My kids in particular are a little bit young to engage in the analysis of stories at this point, but a child of 7, 8, 9, anywhere from there up, this is a great place to talk about them with those kinds of things. And we need more talking about our media, right? Right. I'll answer myself. But whether you're talking to your kids or your friends or your siblings or your parents, my hope for you is that you get some really good talking material out of this movie or out of your story analysis, regardless of what movie you're watching. Even if the movie is fun and lighthearted or silly and fantastical in many ways, there are deep things that we can learn from the stories that we're watching. And my hope for you is that you take your story chops out there and start finding the best stories to learn from and helping those around you to learn from them too. And for the stories that aren't the best, learn from those as well. We can learn from all the stories and make better choices about our media as we talk about them more. One final note before I bid you farewell. If you would like to connect with me about Story Talk, maybe because you just saw an amazing movie and you want to give me a recommendation for it, or if you'd like to tell me your experiences about analyzing stories with your friends and family, I'd love to hear about it. The Twitter account has the handle at StoryTalkFM. But whether you are on social media or think it's the worst, I wish you happy story talks, and we'll see you next time.